Hey, it's Anna Sale, and I want to thank you for listening to Death, Sex, and Money, where I explore the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. You can hear new episodes ad-free every week on Amazon Music, where you can find Death, Sex, and Money and all of your Slate favorites without the ads.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
My job is up for grabs. My marriage is up for grabs. I mean, if I told my mom and my dad where I was, the phone would simply go dead.
This is Death, Sex, and Money, the show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot and need to talk about more. I'm Anna Sale. In our longest relationships, there are ebbs and flows of closeness, sometimes intentional, sometimes not, depending on what's going on in your life or whether it's easy to be together. And then sometimes, no matter how entangled you are, there's a rupture, a break. You become estranged from the people you come from or from the communities that once felt like home.
I have been estranged from my family since I was 16. I moved out and I just never saw them again.
I'm in a 13-year journey of trying to estrange myself and my sister from our mom.
And I haven't spoken to them for the last 129 days.
I don't even know that I'd recognize him on the street if I saw him or recognize his voice.
When we asked you, our listeners, earlier this year about your experiences with estrangement, hundreds of you shared stories. You told us about the moment you knew you were done.
He told me he would not come to my wedding.
She reminded me often that I wasn't wanted. She wanted to have an abortion.
He will just message you out of nowhere, tearing you down, letting you know what a loser he thinks you are.
I was diagnosed with cancer. I just remember, like, I called him and I said, you know, I have something I really need to talk to you about. It's really important. And he said, well, can it wait? I'm just not in a really good place right now.
And that's when I decided to draw a line in the sand.
I was left with this turning point in our relationship.
And I never saw them again.
You described what estrangement feels like in your body.
Estrangement feels like I've lost a limb, and I'm learning how to live without it.
The pain is physical. I wake up with lots of tension in my shoulders.
I feel like I sit and sink in that gray area every single day.
But your estrangement stories were also about finding your strength.
I did what I had to do in order to be able to live with myself.
I'm so proud of myself. And I just mourn for the family that I think I should have had, and I didn't.
It's difficult to find reliable data on how common estrangement is. One national survey published in 2020 found that more than a quarter of American adults had cut off contact with a family member. And that's just one kind of estrangement. Others of you have lost communities, your sense of national identity, or entire belief systems.
I think I was 14 when they officially excommunicated us. My uncle wrote the letter, and everyone signed it.
We are bringing you 3 episodes in this series about different stages of estrangement and varied vantage points. Some of you are years out, decades into making that hard boundary. Others have had estrangement happen to you for reasons you haven't always understood and couldn't control.
He just told me he couldn't come anymore, and he wasn't able to share why.
We heard about the families and communities you've rebuilt after estrangement, and we heard from those of you just newly contemplating the idea, not quite there yet.
How do I do it? Do I let him know? Or do I just block him? Or do I leave him unblocked and just ignore his messages?
I'm sort of mourning this relationship slowly, and I'm just not ready to fully kill it.
That's where Brian was when he reached out to us in early June. He said he felt caught between 2 worlds. On the one hand, his growing disillusionment with the religion he grew up in, and on the other, his wife and parents who are still embedded in that religion. Losing one would mean losing the other.
I'm stuck in a way because my wife is still, for lack of a better word, a true believer, and that connects me to it in a way that I'm just fear-riddled that I'll lose her if I leave completely. Because I know I'll lose my parents completely if I leave. They'll cut me off, 100% cut me off.
Brian asked us not to use his real name or to identify his particular religious community. It's Christian, with meetings and services multiple times a week. He describes the community as high control.
There is real clear guidance on, gosh, everything, like what you should or shouldn't watch on TV, what you should or shouldn't do, and what you read, what movies you see, even rules on what you do and don't do in the bedroom.
Brian said he started to feel doubts in his mid-20s. He's in his mid-40s now.
I think as an adult, you look at your behaviors and you decide which ones are worth maintaining and which ones are not. And the constant pressure to do more for the faith, it left me with this incredible feeling of inadequacy. I could never do enough. And every time you would reach for the goal line or the finish line of whatever it was you were trying to do, it felt like it moved.
Like an exhaustion with trying to please.
Exactly.
And you reached out to us when we asked our listeners about experiences of estrangement. When I asked that, with that word estrangement, what connected for you about that?
You know, when you're raised from the beginning of your formative thought process in a group like I was or am, your entire life perspective is really kind of built on that as its basis, right? And not just morality; it's what you do with your time, how you plan for your future. Even the definition of the word future is different, right? When you're a devout believer, you believe that any time the end could come, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's a separation. The estrangement is a separation, not just from my community, but from an entire belief system.
You said, I was, and then you corrected yourself and said, I am. What is your current relationship to the church community?
I stay in it as much as I have to. And I have to, and that's that, the have to is based upon, is predicated on how much turmoil I want to take on at any given time. I don't want to cause my wife any more stress because of what it would mean for her. And not to mention the fact that the job that I have puts me in touch with or in constant contact with people who are 100% still in that world. And it would, my separation from it would abbreviate or truncate all those relationships.
What does your wife know?
She knows how I feel about the organization. She knows how I feel about the different beliefs that we've had over the years that I no longer hold on to. I think maybe if the one thing I wish I were a little more transparent with her about is just how kind of done with the day-to-day stuff I want to be.
Does she know we're speaking?
Does it make me a bad husband if I say no? Does it change the answer?
I don't know. I don't think it makes you a bad husband either way. Just speaks to where you are in the process, I feel like.
So no, she doesn't. No. Mm-hmm. Because of the way the organization handles marriages, it's to her, my separation from the religion would feel like I was generally calling into question morality, and that it might also include my, I'm trying to think of the word for it. That would include my dedication to her, my promises to her.
I see.
And so I'm a 100% one woman man, and it's always been her since we were kids. It was her. I'm not the kind of guy that looks around. I'm not the kind of guy that is going to show too much attention in the wrong direction. But to have to reaffirm my fidelity as a husband, I don't know. It's irritating. It makes me more mad at the organization that they taught us to believe that way.
Yeah.
I hate it for my wife, because I just can't blind her with the honesty of it. I have to slow roll it, because if I just unload, she won't be able to hear it, and it will terrify her.
So you are trying to figure out how to live honestly while knowing that this is a bomb in your marriage.
Yeah. And so, I mean, the bomb is a super destructive thing, right? Just tears everything apart all at once. And that's not how this would go. That's not how this would go. If it did cause the failure of my marriage, which I have to say out loud, I'm generally unwilling to accept. Mm-hmm. I'm not even generally. I am absolutely unwilling to accept. Mm-hmm. It would be in really small steps. It would be the absence of family invitations, the reduction in family phone calls, the seeing the posts on social media from family members doing things together that we weren't invited to, that would lead to her seeing me as less of an asset to her life and more of a weight.
Like estrangement by a thousand cuts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you and your wife raising kids?
No. Isn't it awful to think that that's a mercy? I don't know. I couldn't teach a kid to believe this way. I couldn't allow it to go by.
Was it intentional not to become parents?
No. No, we tried. Wasn't biologically possible for us.
I imagine that was years ago, but now you see that as a grace, as a blessing.
Yeah, isn't that awful?
No,
it's a major crime, because my wife's maternal instinct is so strong. She would have been the world's greatest mom.
Coming up, Brian talks about why he first started feeling alienated from church.
I watched my brother struggle with the knowledge that his family felt that he was damned. And I've watched my sister deal with the same and how that they have broken themselves trying to regain the approval of their families. It broke my brother till he died. And it almost did that to my sister.
Let me tell you a good story. It was late on a Sunday afternoon, and my family and I had been away and rolled into the driveway, and everyone was worn out from traveling and getting hangry. But waiting for us was a solution. A Hungry Root box filled with healthy, grabbable snacks and a few different dinner meals to choose from. We tore into this thing like a pack of wild animals and ate all the snacks. But they were healthy, whole ingredients, fresh produce. And then we were set for dinner a few hours later, which only took about 15 minutes to prep and cook and get on the table. I was so grateful to my past self for doing my current self this solid by ordering this box. And it was easy. I took a short quiz to tell Hungry Root what kinds of meat my family eats, the sorts of flavors we like, any dietary restrictions we have, or just things we're trying to avoid, and when I wanted the box to be delivered. Right now, Hungry Root is offering Death, Sex, and Money listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life. Just go to hungryroot.com/DSM to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/DSM. And don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home. And you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on Death, Sex, and Money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM Plus to get access wherever you listen. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. Brian told us he wasn't the first person in his family to consider life outside their religious community. Both his siblings, his older brother and younger sister, became estranged from the church and thus their parents. First, it was his brother, who began distancing himself when he was in his early 20s. At the time, Brian was a teenager, still devout, and very disapproving of his brother.
I was always the good kid, and he had all of the pinnings of the rebellious child. And so I just continued to make decisions that I thought mom and dad would be proud of, which put me in the position where my relationship with him was, there was a lot less communication. There was always this fine point. I remember telling him one time that, I was okay to hang out with him and talk and do whatever, but if he ever mentioned anything that was contrary to our religious upbringing, that was just the end of it.
That you couldn't sustain a relationship if he was going to talk to you about that.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I couldn't hear it. There's, I guess for lack of a better word, there's a thought blocking that comes into the way that we're taught that you can't. I've seen it on my wife's face, and I'm sure it was on mine when I talked to my brother. Like, when you get to the point where the discussion goes towards something that isn't in line with the teachings, your face changes, and you can tell the person stopped listening, because they simply cannot hear it. Mm-hmm. And as he grew away from the faith, his lifestyle grew increasingly less like mine, and more like, who he wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And his sexuality was in question to him. And because of my fundamentalist upbringing, I was really cold about that.
Mm-hmm. How long ago did you lose him? Did he die?
It's been about 6 years.
6 years. Are you comfortable sharing how he died?
Man, he drank himself to death.
Oh, that's sad.
Yeah. He went into the hospital on a Thursday. And I went in to talk to him one night, and I leaned in and I said, I love you. And he said, I love you back. And I think I was the last person he spoke to. A couple of days later, his body just gave out. I think the official cause of death was multi-system failure. So, yeah, by Sunday, he was gone.
It's nice that you got to visit him.
Yeah. Yeah, he knew it. He knew how I felt, so.
Did your brother know that how you were thinking about your faith, your individual faith was shifting? No.
No, I think he and I would have been really close right now because of it. I think he would have enjoyed the person I think I'm becoming.
Oh, that's beautiful, and there's such a sadness to that.
I know.
When Brian's younger sister left the faith community at 18, their relationship ended more abruptly. Brian and everyone else in her family cut her off.
She left in a very different way. My brother faded away, which was easier for me to maintain a relationship with him. My sister was pulled away because the congregation decided her behaviors were not ones they could tolerate. So they excommunicated.
She was cast out.
Yes.
And when the church cast her out, you cast her out as well?
I did. I didn't speak to her for almost 20 years.
And she lost her whole community?
She did. All of her friends. All of her friends are lifelong friends. There's even several she probably has yet to be able to communicate with, because she still carries the label that the organization put on her. A scarlet letter, isn't it?
Well, I'm just curious. I just want to make sure I'm understanding. Was it some violation of something about sexual morality?
It's even more trite than that. It was cigarettes. She smoked a cigarette. Other people saw her do it. It was found out. It was reported to the people in charge of that particular congregation. She told her story and they didn't believe she wasn't lying. And it's sick, isn't it? It's sick how small that is. Kid trying cigarettes.
After she was excommunicated, Brian says his sister struggled with drug addiction and got in trouble with the law. They were estranged for 20 years. But when their older brother died, Brian picked up the phone and called his sister.
She was far more forgiving than I deserved, for sure. You can't just apologize for 20 years of silence and all the times you should have said something. I did apologize, but you are what you do and not what you say. So I've got some time left to prove that I meant it, and I intend to and have been. But I was just doing what I was supposed to. I was doing what was, it was considered to be right. When you're brought up that way, you have to stop believing in what is right or what you thought was right. You have to acknowledge that it just wasn't. It was wrong.
Does your sister hold on to any faith? Is she still a believer in some ways in the teachings of the religion you grew up in?
No.
Is she helping you have language to critique the religion you grew up in?
I think it just in trying to be available to her. Yeah, I think she's helped me to kind of work around some of the same thought blocks that I had in place. There's a really good friend of mine who was even more involved in the group that I was, who pulled himself out of it and his family. And he and I have kept in really close communication. And that's helped a lot too, is to have someone to talk that out with. I'm not the most emotionally mature or conscious person. A lot of times I'm like a little kid who cries because he's both hungry and tired. And I don't know. So I'll cry and not know why. And I think he's helped me out a lot with that, knowing why. Instead of just being a general wad of anxiety and anger.
Is your relationship with this friend secret?
No, that's, because his family is still nearby, and I'll still bump into them occasionally. But it is known that he's left. And because he left and I maintain communication, it puts me on the watch list. I won't hide that from the religious community, that I am both communicating with my sister and that I am communicating with my friend. I won't hide that. Because to me, that would feel like I was doing the same thing. I owe it to my sister, who I can still prove it to, and I owe it to my brother's memory to not be ashamed of them.
That's a listener we're calling Brian. Since we talked a few months ago, Brian emailed us an update. I had an open conversation with my parents about where I'm at. The result has been what I thought, a dismissive withdrawal of most normal communication, he wrote. But he said he felt better having been honest with them. My wife has come to a better understanding of where I am, Brian continued. She's been very forgiving, but still doesn't want to talk about it. And he said, she still doesn't know about the podcast. On next week's episode, stories from listeners about choosing estrangement and how they did it.
Once they landed in Poland and they send me the text like we landed, that's when I blocked their phone numbers and their email addresses.
And we hear from listeners who had estrangement done to them.
Went out to the porch. It was January and it was cold. And I remember picking up the note and being so excited by having a note from my daughter.
What was your daughter writing to tell you?
That she no longer wanted to hear from me.
Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios in New York. This episode was produced by Zoe Azoulay. The rest of our team is Liliana Maria Percy Ruiz, Afi Yellowduke, Tracy Hunt, Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Andrew Dunn, who composed original music for this series. Julia Furlan and Lily Clark also worked on this series with us, and it started with a pitch from our former intern, Gabriella Santana. The Reverend John DeLore and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. Thank you to Molly Ryan from Dorchester, Massachusetts, for being a member of Death, Sex, and Money and supporting us with a monthly donation. Join Molly and support what we do here by going to deathsexmoney.org/donate. I'm on Instagram at AnnaSailPix, that's P-I-C-S, and the show is at Death, Sex, Money on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Brian says he sometimes goes to online chat rooms where they use different lingo to describe the various states of leaving religion, like this acronym for being physically part of a community but mentally outside of it. Have you heard the term PIMO?
Physically in, mentally out.
Yeah.
Did you just get on Reddit?
Is that where you are?
With 100% certainty. Yeah.
That's the only thing that's certain right now. You're
like, I know.
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.